Blog Talk Radio.
There's a direct relationship between having the businesses and being in prison. Go find an Asian, see how many Asians you can find in American prisons. They ain't gonna be in there. But 51% of your prisoners will be black because blacks don't have any businesses and industries. There's a direct link. Blacks won't practice group economics. Blacks won't practice group politics. If you don't practice, you're setting yourselves up. I told you that five-story building, you're setting yourself to get wiped out. Understand the nature of race, which is economics. If you build the first floor, it's economic. Build your businesses and your industries. Control business and industry, and put that pulls in your money, and hold that money, and practice group economics with it. Arab and Asian money bounces 12 to 13 times for at least. Jewish money bounces 18 times. Black folk got to learn how to practice group economics. Black Americans spend every penny they get outside their own community. Then you take the money and the wealth that you get from that first floor and go to the second floor. The second floor is politics. You then take that money on the first floor and you control your politics. Black folk must quit allowing people to tell them to go out and vote. Vote for what? Nobody's going to do anything for black folk in politics. Politics is controlled by money. Major corporations, who got the money? That's what controls politics. If you have no money, you have no say-so, you have no benefits coming. So you take your money and you control and you take your money on the first floor, you buy every politician on the second floor. And any politician you can't buy, you rent or lease them to get what you need. Then once you get the second floor under control with the politician, with your money, then you go to the third floor. The third floor then is the police department and the court system. You take your money from the first floor and your politics on the second floor and you control the court system and the police department. Then the fourth floor then is media. You then take the money that you generate off the first floor from business and industries and you go after radio stations, TV stations, newspapers, and cable systems so that you can now inform and communicate with your own people. Right now, black folk own and control less than 35 thousandths of 1% of the media in the United States. Out of 12,000 radio stations, black folk own about something like about 75 or 80. That's all. You own no cable systems. You don't have a daily newspaper. You have nothing of importance. You got about one black TV station. So you can't communicate with your people. You can't inform your people. You can't do anything. You can have Rush Limbaugh and all the rest of the guys talking about racism all day long and bad mouthing you. And O'Reilly, they can call black folk all kind of names all day long. What are you going to do? You can't respond. You can't even communicate with your own people because you don't have an economic base. 51% of all the prisoners in the United States are black people. You only make up 12% of the population. That's no accident. It's because you don't control the economics and the politics. And they're going to go after the weakest people they can get their hands on to incarcerate them. That's the black folk. And what are you going to do in response to them when they over-incarcerate you? You're going to go out and have a march, a demonstration. We're going to march. March for what? Who cares? Marches, they never changed anything.
Now, learn this from Joel Osteen. That's my man. He be texting me. That's my man. God done put some people around me, show me some stuff. He was telling this story. He said this man that went to heaven, and he was walking with Peter down this aisleway, and it was going down this corridor, had a lot of doors on it, and said all these doors had names on it. And he said, Peter, let me ask you something. What's all these doors, these names on? He said, don't worry about it. Just go ahead. So he kept walking. He messed around. He saw one of them doors and had his name on it. He said, whoa. He said, hey, Peter, this here ain't got my name on it. Something I need to know? He said, man, don't worry about that. You here now. Just go on in there and talk to him. See what he's here. He said, nah, I won't know what's in the door. He said, you sure you won't see what's in the door? He said, yeah. So he opened up the door. It was a warehouse. It had number shelves on it. And then the shelves had nothing but packages. And all the packages had his name on them. And he said, what is all these boxes? He said, that's all of the blessings, all of the things God wanted to ship to you. But number one, you didn't ask him for it. Then number two, you didn't believe you would have it. Then you doubted him. And then you felt like you wasn't worthy. And so now all these boxes is up here. Now the man standing there wishing he had never even been in the room. And I started thinking. I got some dudes that work for me. And I said, I want you to do this graph for me. And that's what I'm finna show you now. See, what happened is, when God sends your package, he only sends it to one street. That's Faith Street. You got to stay in faith. You can't move off of Faith Street. You can't get on Doubted Drive. You can't be over there and start doubting it because your package going to go right on by. You can't lose your faith and get on Not Meant to Be Way because your package is going to keep going right on by. Because the package just go to Faith Street. You can get your little feelings hurt, I ain't worthy. Guess what? Your package going to keep going right on by. You have not because you ask not. Then you sit up here and start feeling sorry for yourself. You go on Pity Way, your package keep going right on by. If you stay right on Faith Street, don't ever come off, because the blessing is coming. If you wait on it, here it comes. It may not come when you want it, but it on time. But if you get up and you move off of Faith Street, your box gonna get sent back to sender. And now you're gonna have a warehouse with a bunch of boxes with your name on it that you didn't never get. And I don't know about you, but I want everything he got for me. If he got something for me, I need all of mine. Because I don't know about you, but God lay you out, man. God will give you stuff. Man, he done took me places. I ain't never thought I was going to go. I done seen parts of the world I never even thought I could go to. He done gave me stuff. He done put people in my life. God will do it for you, man. But you just got to stay, man. Use these principles of success. Understand, God is just that way. He'll lay you out. Because if he can lay me out, see, if he fix me and change me and get me over here trying to do better, I ain't perfect. I'm just trying to do better. I still say some stuff I ain't supposed to say. You understand? I ain't got it all together yet. I just got in the gate. I'm a new kind of Christian. But ain't no lock on my gate either. So if you see, once you check me, I'm probably going to check you back. But I'm getting better at that. I don't know how to love my enemies yet. I'm getting better at it, though. But it's a process. And the more times we can make people understand that it's a process, the more people can come in. And y'all people that have been good to me, that have been praying for me. I mean, man, my mama, if she could see me now, I just wish my mama could see me. Because she's been praying for this hill all her life. Watch my son. Well, he done watched me, mama. And I'm cool now. And my philosophy is very simple. I was who I was, but I am who I am. And I'm cool with both them people. Because who I was wasn't that bad a cap. I made some mistakes, but I've been changed a little bit. And it's still a process. And the more people that you invite into the process, the better this is. Because ain't nobody perfect no how. So I really appreciate y'all, man, hearing me and listening to me. I'm going to ask Kirk Franklin if he will come.
Many a young athlete entertains hoop dreams. Few, if any, have tried as hard to make them come true as the kid our Steve Hartman has gone to see.
Every week, he set himself up for disappointment. Every week. 13-year-old Jamarian Stiles came to this community center in Boca Raton, Florida, hoping to play basketball with the other kids. And every week, he was rejected.
They'll start picking teams, and I would be the only one left out. And then they'll just tell me, just go home and stuff. You can break someone's heart like that.
The problem was obvious to everyone but Jamarian. He lost his hands and most of his arms as an infant due to a rare bacterial infection. But he insisted that was no reason to give up his hoop dreams.
What about soccer? Have you heard of that sport?
Yeah, hear it every day.
Why don't you play soccer? That just seems like the obvious thing.
You would think that I would be good at soccer. I'm really not. I'm horrible.
Which is why, on the first day of class here at Eagles Landing Middle School, Jamarian took his case to basketball coach Darian Williams.
Yeah.
Said he wanted to be on the team this year.
I said, all great, well, just make sure you try out.
He said, okay, great, but what are you really thinking?
This man has no arms.
Yeah.
How is he going to play basketball? But, man, he told me, Mr. Williams, I've never been on a team before. Even if I don't play, I just want to be on the team. And how could I say no to that?
And that's how the Eagles got their first armless basketball player. Jamarian, number two there, quickly earned a reputation as the hardest worker on the squad.
He was usually the first one in the gym, usually the last one to leave.
Still, he sat on the bench most of the season.
Try one more.
Until last month. Coach put him in the game with about 6 minutes left. And when he eventually got the ball on the far side of the court, everyone yelled, "Shoot it!" So he did. And sank. A three-pointer. And if you didn't quite see that, don't worry. Because shortly after, he got the ball again. This time on the near side. For another three-pointer. At the buzzer. Jamarian Stiles, the kid no one would pick, was now everyone's hero. Needless to say, today, Jamarian can play all he wants at the community center. He just made the volleyball team and has every intention of playing football next year. Really, the only thing he won't play is the victim.
If I could wave a magic wand right now and give you your arms back, would you want them?
I don't need them.
You don't need them?
No.
Who needs hands when you've got this kind of touch?
Hi everybody, I'm Jonathan Fields and this is Good Life Project. So my guest today is Josh Kaufman, and this is a special episode. One of the things that we've discovered through a lot of our viewers is that the process of trying to live a good life, a better life, often requires you learning a new set of skills. We've had a ton of questions over the last year from people who say, I would love to do this, but I don't have time in my life to do it. I don't want to wait forever to make it happen. So we're bringing you Josh, who's also the author of a book called The First 20 Hours, who's an expert in, I guess, what I would call accelerated learning. So great to be hanging out with you today.
Thanks for having me. Great to hang out.
Couldn't sort of like have asked for a better person to drop in at a better time, because it really is. It's an interesting thing. It seems like the world is moving faster.
Mm-hmm.
We all want to get stuff done. A lot of people want to make big changes and feel like they're living better lives, but they look out there and they're like, there's stuff that I need to know, stuff I need to learn, stuff I need to master to do it. And I just don't have time in the day to
right.
do it.
Right.
So I'm curious. I mean, I want to get like right in with you, sort of like the idea behind your book.
Sure.
But one quick question first, which is, what was the motivation for you to actually go down this rabbit hole?
Yeah. So two primary motivations. The first is, you know, in terms of the research and the writing that I do, I like to look at topics that are like fundamental human experiences, like things that everybody needs to know or everybody deals with in some way, shape, or form. And those things can be, you know, big and complex and scary and frustrating in a lot of ways. But if you just dive in and break it down, what you often find is it's not really as hard as it feels.
Mm-hmm.
And so part of the motivation was, you know, learning is something, you know, learning new skills is a fundamental part of what it is to be human. Mm-hmm. And so let's figure out how to do that. Let's figure out how to do it better.
For me, the thought of learning new stuff, I'm giddy. I love
yeah.
it. But for a lot of people,
it's terrifying.
Right.
Right. Particularly if it's something you know would be super fun or super valuable, but you know nothing about it, and you just look at
right.
it like, oh my gosh, this is really big. The motivation for me personally was I run my own business. My wife Kelsey runs her own business. And 2.5 years ago, our daughter Leela came into the world, and all of a sudden we had zero,
right.
zero free time. And so, you know, I just like you, I really geek out about this stuff. I have a list of things that I want to learn a mile long. And so, you know, not having any time, it's like, okay, I may only be able to set aside, you know, half an hour, 45 minutes a day.
Yes.
So if that's all I have, then, you know, let's figure out how right. to learn as quickly as possible in that short period.
And at the same time, you don't want to wait forever to,
exactly.
to get results. I mean, that's,
yeah.
a lot of people are like, okay, I could figure out, like, I could scrap somehow to find, like, that half an hour a day, but does doing it so little mean that it's going to take me, like, 10 years
yes.
to actually be decent enough at it so it'll actually be fun?
Right. And what I found through my research is that totally not the case. It doesn't take very long.
Yeah.
Even if you know absolutely nothing, or you only have a certain amount of time every day to sit down and learn it, you can become very, very good at something in a very short period of time.
Mm.
I think that's fun.
So, but this flies in the face to a certain extent also in what like has commonly become known as the 10,000 hour rule.
Sure. A little bit. It's actually a lot more complimentary than it would seem at the surface. So the whole idea of the 10,000 hour rule came from research by Kay Anders Erickson, Florida State University. And the idea behind that was, you know, if you look at the people in ultra-competitive, easily ranked fields, professional golfers, musicians, all of these folks where you can get an estimate of who really is the best in the world in an objective level.
Right.
The question that Dr. Erickson was researching is, what does it take to get to that level,
right,
on
like
some
top,
very
top
narrow
top
thing? Yeah. So yeah, if you want to step on a golf course and compete with Tiger Woods, that's about the amount of time it's going to take you to get there. But the vast majority of us, that's not the goal. That's not what we're trying to do. Mm-hmm. We just may have something in our minds that we want to accomplish, or an area of life we want to explore. And it takes a lot less time to get what we want out
of something. And I guess for a lot of people, the motivation is probably one of two things. You want to get good enough so you enjoy doing it.
Yeah.
Or maybe like professionally, you want to develop a skill set enough so that you can actually start to leverage it to
Absolutely.
Build your career or change your career for a lot of people.
Yeah. There are a bunch of things that you can learn that can help you, you know, do better in your business. There are a bunch of things that you can do to do for fun. It doesn't take that long.
Yeah. So let's dive right into it, because you kind of have a methodology that you developed. So take us through it's five sort of like core ideas.
Yeah. Okay. Right. So the first step in this process, and this is something that applies to every skill. Could be a motor skill, like, you know, learning how to fly an airplane or skateboard or something like that. Could be a cognitive skill, like language or programming or something. So the first step is deciding exactly what it is you want, right? Why are you jazzed about this thing in the first place? If you're able to really clearly define what it is you're trying to get, it's called setting a target performance level. The more clearly that level of performance, the more clearly you can define that, the easier it is for you to look out into the world and find ways to get there in the most direct way possible. Right?
So like, what's an example of that?
So for example, for me, I learned a lot of things in the process of putting together this book. And one of the things that I wanted to be able to do was program. And so instead of just saying, I want to be a programmer, right? Doesn't give you any information whatsoever.
So amorphous.
Here is this idea of a program that I would like to sit down and create from nothing. And it looks like A, B, C, D, E, F, G. When I make this thing, I'll have developed the skills that are necessary in order to get the particular result, right?
Got it.
So instead of learning everything in the world about programming, I decided this is the subsegment of that skill I'm interested in learning first, so that's what I'm going to focus on first.
So it has to be like very goal-oriented and also very specific.
Yes. So what is it going to look like when you're done? What are you going to be able to see or experience that'll let you know you reached the level?
If you want to learn a language, is I want to speak French enough, or is it
not enough?
So like,
yeah,
what would that look like in your sort of like framework?
So let's say, for example, I want to go to a restaurant that has a French-speaking waiter, and I want to order and conduct the entire meal in this language. And have a good time doing it. That's something that's specific enough to practice.
Got it. Okay.
So you almost make it too specific at the beginning, because once you get to that level, you can always ratchet up the stakes, right? You reach that threshold, practice something else.
I mean, what I found is once you get the most baseline proficiency in something, it sucks less.
Yes.
And now you actually like that baseline level. It creates a whole new level of motivation to want to learn more, because now you've kind of gotten through like the scales in music or something like that.
Yeah, and it's important to understand that the first couple hours of practicing something new are frustrating.
Yeah.
For everyone. Everybody's terrible at the beginning. And so, you know, if you can push through those early few hours, the practice itself becomes fun and it becomes way easier to continue to improve.
So that's number one.
Yes.
Number two.
Okay, so after you decide what you want, you do what's called deconstructing the skill. And the idea behind that is a lot of the things that we think of as skills, like, for example, playing golf or speaking French or learning how to program, those aren't exactly skills. They're really kind of general topics that contain lots of smaller sub-skills.
Right.
So it's really hard to practice being a good golfer. It's way easier to practice hitting off of the tee with a driver. Right. So
right.
You take the global skill and you break it up into much smaller parts. And if you're clear about what you want, it becomes very easy to find what are those sub-skills, what are the smaller parts that are actually going to help you get to that target performance level as quickly as possible.
So like if there are 100 sub-skills, if you've done number one, it makes it much easier to figure out, okay, what are the 15 of those sub-skills that are going to give me 80% of the results towards getting where I want to go.
And what you often find is it's only maybe two or three sub-skills that you use most of the time.
Huh.
Yeah. So it's just, you know, breaking it down into small enough chunks. If you do just a little bit of research, which is actually step three, right? You go out into the world and you find sources of information that help you do this deconstruction. If you look at, you know, say for example, pick up five books on whatever it is that you're trying to learn how to do. Mm. Don't read them cover to cover. Skim all of them, one right after the other.
Right.
And what you'll see is the two or three sub-skills that you're going to use most of the time are the ones that come up over and over again.
Ah,
right? So you just practice those first. And if you spend your time practicing those things and avoid a lot of the distractions or things that aren't going to help you, you save a lot of time and energy as you're practicing.
So that's a big question, so I'll ask you now. If out of a whole basket of potential sub-skills that add up to this thing that you want to accomplish, only a small handful are very often really, really critical, why are we taught to do them all at once?
Yeah, I don't have a good answer for that, actually. I think the biggest thing is we treat, in our culture now, learning as a very academic exercise. Like the objective is to suck in a ton of information about this thing, whether or not you're going to use it. And I think, you know, education in our culture now has been seen in the academic sense and less in the sense of practicing something with the eye of using it to do some particular cool thing.
So it's less applied.
Yeah.
More
so theory. You know, the whole idea of researching the topic. And something that I had to train myself out of is I love doing research, right? So the first thing, like programming was a good example of this for me. It's like, I want to learn how to program. I get 10 books, and I have these courses, and I'm going to go through all of this stuff, and then I'm going to sit down and write a program.
Hmm.
It's like, no, you use the research, do just enough research to help you do the deconstruction and find the most important sub-skills first, and then get out of research mode and into practice mode as quickly as you can.
Because that's where the real stuff's going to happen.
Yeah. And when you start practicing what it is you're actually trying to do, that's when you see the performance improvement.
Now, you also made a differentiation when we started the conversation between cognitive skills, like learning a language, and did you use motor skills?
Yep.
Motor skills, you know, like swinging a bat or, you know, playing golf. Do all of these steps, I mean, we still have two more to work through, but you know, with the three that we covered so far, are they all sort of equally relevant to both types of learning?
Yeah, so for both types of learning, you have to go through the same general process. Some of the actual practice techniques can be different. So for example, one of the things that you can do when you're practicing a motor skill, which works really well, is practice it within a couple hours of going to sleep. Either taking a nap or going to bed for the night. There's a lot of research around the idea of what's called consolidation. So your brain translates the practice and experience you had and encodes neural connections to help you do it better.
Right.
That practice or that process is way more efficient if you practice within about 4 hours of going to sleep. So I, in the process of writing the first 20 hours, I retaught myself how to touch type on a different keyboard, which is like, you know, having the experience of rewiring my brain to do something differently.
Right.
And then, you know, fun things like playing the ukulele, which is all motor skills. And it was surreal experience. I would practice it right before I would go to bed. And, you know, the first couple hours of practice was just terrible.
Right.
So I would practice, I'd go to bed, I'd pick it up first thing in the morning just to see. And it was like astounding how much better I was after a couple hours sleep.
That's amazing.
Because, you know, sleep helps consolidate that kind of
stuff. Yeah, no, that's really cool.
So some of the actual practice techniques are different, but the same, the general process is the same.
Right. So that's pretty remarkable. You literally wake up in the morning and you're better than you were when you went to sleep just because you slept in the middle of it.
Absolutely. So for
like noticeably better, like really?
Noticeably better. Like, you know, in the process of learning typing, like, you know, once I switched keyboard format, I went from typing about as fast as I could think to literally like 5 words per minute, like terrible.
Right.
And so, you know, practicing right before bed and getting up in the morning and trying to use my computer, like, in the first couple of days I was doing it, it was like, oh my gosh, I can actually, like, type now. I can do something.
That's crazy.
And, yeah. So, you know, that type of thing works for a motor skill. For cognitive skills, memorization techniques like spaced repetition reinforcement, like flashcard model or flashcards with feedback helping you remember things works really well. So yeah, the actual practice techniques can be very different, but the core method of learning is very much the same.
And again, for both of them, before you go to bed,
yes,
helps with consolidation.
Absolutely.
Very interesting. What about simulated practice?
Simulated practice can be effective as long as it is as close to real world performance as you can make it.
Right.
So, you know, a lot of the, you know, trying to memorize something and then having that translate directly into practice doesn't really work.
Yeah, I guess I'm thinking more in terms of like motor skills.
Okay.
Yeah, like when I was a gymnast when I was a kid, we would, you know, before any event, you know, I would basically, before I would step up to a piece of apparatus, I would kind of close my eyes and I would actually envision my body, like moving through the entire thing.
Okay.
And then there was all this research that said that, you know, it triggers all the same motor neurons that would be triggered, like the same response in your brain.
Yes.
As if you were actually doing it. But I'm curious in terms of sort of like, you know, accelerated learning, whether that would actually make you progress faster and towards a high level of proficiency in that skill.
Yeah. There is quite a bit of research that says that imaginary types of practice does work, and it works well, with a catch, which is you have to do it in addition to
the
physical practice.
Right.
So if you're starting to consolidate those motor movements and you're doing that in practice, and then you're reinforcing that with imagined practice, awesome.
Got it.
But you know what I found is a lot of people get caught up in the process of just doing the physical practice first.
So we got to three of the five steps now. Mm-hmm. So let's kind of like close the loop here. So step number four.
Okay. Step number four is removing barriers to practice. So things that are preventing you from actually sitting down and doing the work.
Okay.
Sometimes those things are environmental distractions, like, you know, turning off the TV or blocking the internet or closing the door. You know, all of the things that you can do to make sure in those early hours of practice, which are frustrating, you don't get so frustrated that it's easy to stop focusing on whatever it is that you're doing and start paying attention to something else. You know, likewise, anything that you can do to make sure it takes as little energy as possible to start practicing is super helpful at that point. So, you know, instead of keeping your guitar in the case in the back of the closet on the other side of your house,
right?
Take the guitar out of the case, get a stand, put it right next to your next to your couch. And that just, you know, anything that you can do to make it easier on yourself to get those early hours of practice, the better.
Yeah, I mean, my guitar is actually hanging out on a rack because of that. It's like, almost because I just forget it's even there.
Totally.
You know, it's like the visual cue actually makes a really big difference for me. Yeah. All right, so number four is, now, I'm curious also, I mean, it sounds like there's a bit of crossover between that and sort of like B.J. Fogg's work on really
tiny habits.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. It's, you know, a lot of the same, you know, this is where the behavioral psychology elements of this come in.
Right.
It's how can you make it easier to do the thing that you want to be doing instead of getting distracted by some shiny object and going and doing something else. So instead of relying on exerting a lot of willpower to force yourself to do this thing that you've decided you want to do, you spend a little bit of willpower, a little bit of time and energy altering the structure of the environment around you.
Right.
And just make it easier, easy as possible to do the thing that you want
to
do.
Yeah, totally makes sense.
Yeah.
All right, last item, number
last
five.
Last one. Pre-commit to practicing at least 20 hours. And this is the big one. So all the things that we've talked about so far is getting set up to sit down and do the work of actually practicing. The pre-commitment and the idea of practicing at least 20 hours, there's a lot of behavioral psychology behind that. The two big things is, first, it's a really important check on your reasons for learning this thing in the first place.
So it's kind of like, if I'm not willing to commit to 20 hours, I can't be all that serious about it.
Yeah, it's like, is it worthwhile for me to rearrange my schedule and stop doing other things? And, you know, is this something that I'm expecting to get enough benefit from to make the effort worth it?
Yeah.
If it's not, don't do it.
Right.
Life is short, you know? It's like, go do something else that you will get more benefit out of or you are more excited about. So if you're willing to set aside at least 20 hours, what the pre-commitment does is make sure that you practice long enough to push through that early frustration and actually start seeing results. And I think a lot of us really seriously overestimate just how long it takes to become good at something. Mm. So you can become really, really good at something, surprisingly good at something, in as little as 20 hours. Mm. So if you practice that long, you're going to be way better at the end of that than you were at the beginning.
Yeah. I guess a lot of people also figure, well, you know, 20 hours, you know, I've done that with a million different things, and you know, I really wasn't very good. But probably when they actually look back and say, well, no, like I missed 3 days here, and like that one day where I, you know, said I was practicing for an hour, I was really only practicing for 10 minutes. So when you really add up all the time, I'm guessing there's a little bit of self-delusion that happens.
There's actually quite a bit of research behind this. Our minds are not built to accurately estimate time. And in the early parts of learning something new, it's like, you know, it's terrible. It's like, oh man, I've been at this hours. And you look at the clock and you've been at it 10 minutes.
Right.
And so a lot of the, you know, both pre-committing to a certain amount of practicing. So 20 hours roughly is about 40 minutes a day per month,
okay,
give or take.
So you kind of think in your mind, 40 minutes a day per
yeah.
month.
So a couple of, and I usually break my practice sessions into about 20 minutes a piece, right? So 2 20-minute practice sessions every day for about a month cool. can get you there. And so, you know, if you're able and willing to do that, pre-committing the time, make sure that you practice long enough to see that really good result. But it's also, you know, psychologically not, it doesn't feel like that big of a hurdle to say, okay, this is important to me.
Right.
I can set aside at least that amount of time, right? So it's just enough that you're going to see dramatic results, but not so much that it prevents you from making the pre-commitment in
right.
the first place.
I love that. So let's recap the 5 steps.
Okay. So the 5 steps in order. Step 1, decide what you want. What's your target performance level? Mm. Step 2 is deconstruct the scale. Separate it into smaller subscales. Practice the most important ones first. Number 3 is research the skill just enough to do the deconstruction and choose the most important subskills, but not so much that it becomes a barrier to practice mm-hmm. in itself. Number 4 is eliminate barriers to practice. Make it easy to do what you want to do. And number 5 is pre-commit to practicing whatever it is that you want to be able to do for at least 20 hours.
Mm. Love it. All right. So my mind is spinning because I'm thinking to myself, okay, what am I going to do?
I was going to ask, what's in the back of your mind? Have you always wanted to learn how to do?
Essentially, I mean, languages. Because I don't speak another language. Mm-hmm. I took Latin for 6 years, which means I speak nothing but English. It's interesting. Like, I want to blurt out a whole bunch of different things, but number 5 is making me say, I need to really think about this.
Yeah.
Because I don't want to, like, say, okay, people, I'm going to commit to this publicly.
Yeah.
And then, like, you know, an hour after we film this, I'm like, I'm not really, like, willing to put in my 20 hours for that. Mm-hmm. So it's interesting. I'm really thinking that through. Awesome conversation, and I love sort of like the breakdown that you have. And this is all, I mean, obviously detailed and, you know, a whole bunch more extensively in the first 20 hours. But thanks for stopping by and sharing this with me, because like I said, one of the consistent questions that we keep getting from people is, you know, I know that for me to get to a place where I feel like, you know, like I'm living well in the world, I'm doing these things, career, personal, whatever it is, there's a body of knowledge that I need to know and get decent at. But I don't know how to do it, and I think it's going to take forever. So I think this is a really great formula to help people get there.
Thanks. And, you know, I think the really good news is that the outcome of this research is the barrier to sitting down and learning something new is not intellectual.
Mm.
We're all smart enough to sit down and figure it out and practice in a
right.
smart way. The barrier is emotional. And so, you know, a lot of these things are just working with ourselves in a smart way to decide we're interested in doing something, figure out how to do it and actually sit down and
nice.
Practice so we can do a bunch of cool stuff.
Love it.
That's fun.
Awesome.
All right.
Fantastic.
Thanks for having me.
My pleasure. My guest today has been Josh Kaufman, the author of The First 20 Hours. I'm Jonathan Fields, signing off for Good Life Project.
Malcolm Gladwell is here. He is a staff writer for the New Yorker magazine. His first two books, The Tipping Point and Blink, each sold well over 2 million copies in the United States. His unique take on the world ultimately has even spawned its own term, Gladwellian. His new book is called Outliers, The Story of Success. I am very pleased to have him back at this table. Welcome back.
Thank you.
Happy now tell me, I said to you as you sat down, I am fascinated by performance and success, and success in terms of the essence of it. And how do you get there? Not that there's a magic formula, you know, but what can we understand about it?
No, it is. It's this sort of perennially interesting question, and there are so many different answers depending on who you ask and when you ask them, and that's why we keep returning to it. If it was some little simple algorithm we could apply, it wouldn't capture our imagination in the same way.
It is said that part of the reason for this book, and there is some personal biography here, you talk about your grandmother, was that you were in search of explaining your own success, this phenomenal success you've had.
Yeah, well, I don't know if it was a conscious attempt. I would never do something so explicitly autobiographically, consciously. But I suppose on some level, I mean, that question began to occur to me because my own success doesn't seem to me to be entirely rational, or it certainly wasn't anything I would have expected.
And you couldn't necessarily look at particular biographical points and say, aha, this guy is going to be either president or write bestsellers.
Yeah, it seemed...